The two sets of brothers met at another church-related event, in this case, Vacation Bible School. The Fergusons had a family membership at Goat Mountain Resort, and sometimes Con and Andy would go with them in the Ferguson station wagon to swim and have lunch in the club. The pool, they said, was about 1,000 times better than Harry's Pond. Neither Terry nor I cared much about this. The local swimming hole was fine by us, and we had our own friends. But it drove Claire wild with envy. She wanted to see how the other half lived. "They live just like us, dear," Mom said. "Whoever said the rich are different was wrong." Claire, who was running clothes through our old washing machine's wringer, scrunched her face into a pout. "I doubt that," she said. "Andy says the girls who swim in the pool wear bikinis," I said. My mother snorted. "They might as well go swimming in their bras and underpants." "I'd like to have a bikini," Claire remarked. It was, I suppose, the sort of provocation girls of 17 specialize in. My mother pointed a finger at her, soap dripping from one short-clipped nail. "That's how girls get pregnant, Missy." Claire returned that serve smartly. "Then you ought to keep Con and Andy from going. They might get a girl pregnant." "Zip your lip," my mother said, cutting her eyes in my direction. "Little pitchers have big ears." Like I didn't know what getting a girl pregnant meant. Sex. Boys lay down on top of girls and wiggled around until they got the feeling. When that happened, a mysterious something called jizz came from the boy's dink. It sank into the girl's belly, and 9 months later, it was time for diapers and a baby carriage. My parents didn't stop Con and Andy from going to the resort once or twice a week during the summer, in spite of my sister's dog in the manger barking. And when the Fergusons came up for February vacation in 1965 and invited my brothers to go skiing with them, my parents sent them off to Goat Mountain without a qualm. My brothers' scarred old skis strapped to the station wagon's roof, right along with the Fergusons' gleaming new ones. When they came back, there was a bright red wheal across Con's throat. "Did you drift off course and run into a tree branch?" Dad asked when he came home for supper and saw the mark. Con, a fine skier, was indignant.
"Gosh, no, Dad. Me and Norm were racing. We were side by side, going like Hell's Kitchen."
Mom pointed her fork at him.
"Sorry, Mom." "Like Heck's Kitchen. Norm hit a mogul and just about lost his balance. He stuck out his arm like this,"
Con demonstrated, almost knocking over his glass of milk.
"And his ski pole hit me in the neck. It hurt like, you know, bad, but it's better now."
Only it wasn't. The next day the red mark had faded to a necklace-like bruise, but his voice had gotten hoarse. By that night he could hardly speak above a whisper. 2 days later, he was completely mute. A hyperextension of the neck resulting in a stretched laryngeal nerve. That was Dr. Renault's diagnosis. He had seen them before, and in a week or two, Conrad's voice would begin to come back. By the end of March, Connie would be right as a trivet. Nothing to worry about, he said. And there wasn't. Not for him, at least. His voice was fine. This was not true of my brother. When April rolled around, Con was still writing notes and making gestures when he wanted something. He insisted on going to school, even though the other boys had started making fun of him, especially since he had solved the problem of class participation, to a degree anyway, by writing yes on one palm and no on the other. He had a pile of file cards with more communications written on them in block letters. The one his classmates found particularly hilarious was, "May I use the restroom?" Con seemed to take all this in good spirits, knowing that to do otherwise would only make the teasing worse. But one night I went into the room he shared with Terry and found him lying on his bed and weeping soundlessly. I went to him, asking what was wrong. A stupid question, since I knew. But you have to say something in that situation, and I could say it, because I wasn't the one who'd been struck across the throat with the ski pole of destiny.
"Get out," he mouthed, his cheeks and forehead
studded with newly arrived pimples, were flaming. His eyes were swollen.
"Get out! Get out!"
Then, shocking me,
"Get the fuck out, cocksucker!"
The first gray began to appear in my mother's hair that spring. One afternoon, when my father came in, looking more tired than usual, Mom told him they had to take Con to a specialist in Portland. "We've waited long enough," she said. "That old fool George Renault can say whatever he likes, but I know what happened, and so do you. That careless rich boy ruptured my son's vocal cords." My father sat down heavily at the table. Neither of them noticed me in the mudroom, taking an inordinate amount of time to lace up my keds. "We can't afford it, Laura," he said. "But you could afford to buy Hiram Oil in Gates Falls," she said, using an ugly, almost sneering tone of voice I had never heard before. He sat, looking at the table instead of at her, although there was nothing on it except the red and white checked oilcloth. "That's why we can't afford it. We're skating on mighty thin ice. You know what kind of winter it was." "We all knew. A warm one. When your family's income depends on heating oil, you keep a close eye on the thermometer between Thanksgiving and Easter, hoping the red line will stay low." My mother was at the sink, hands buried in a cloud of soap suds. Somewhere beneath the cloud, dishes were rattling as if she wanted to break them instead of clean them. "You had to have it, didn't you?" Still in that same tone of voice. I hated that voice. It was as if she was egging him on. "The big oil baron." "That deal was made before Con's accident," he said, still not looking up. His hands were once more stuffed deep into his pockets. "That deal was made in August. We sat together looking at the old farmer's almanac. A cold and snowy winter, it said, coldest since the end of World War II. And we decided it was the right thing to do. You ran the numbers on your adding machine." The dishes rattled harder under the soap suds. "Take out a loan." "I could, but Laura, listen to me." He raised his eyes at last. "I may have to do that, just to make it through the summer." "He's your son. I know he is, goddammit," Dad roared. It scared me, and must have scared my mother, because this time the dishes under the cloud of suds did more than rattle. They crashed, and when she raised her hands, one of them was bleeding. She held it up to him, like my silent brother showing yes or no in class, and said, "Look what you made me do." She caught sight of me, sitting on the woodpile and staring into the kitchen. "Buzz off. Go out and play." "Laura, don't take it out on you." "Get out," she shouted. It was the way Con would have shouted at me if he'd had a voice to shout with. "God hates a snoop." She began to cry. I ran out the door, crying myself. I ran down Methodist Hill and across Route 9 without looking in either direction. I had no idea of going to the parsonage. I was too upset to even think of seeking pastoral advice. If Patsy Jacobs hadn't been in the front yard, checking to see if any of the flowers she'd planted the previous fall were coming up, I might have run until I collapsed. But she was out, and she called my name. Part of me wanted to just keep on running, but, as I think I've said, I had my manners, even when I was upset. So I stopped. She came to where I was standing, my head down, gasping for breath.
"What happened, Jamie?"
I didn't say anything. She put her fingers under my chin and raised my head. I saw Maury sitting on the grass beside the parsonage's front stoop, surrounded by toy trucks. He was goggling at me.
"Jamie, tell me what's wrong."
Just as we had been taught to be polite, we had been taught to keep our mouths shut about what went on in the family. It was the Yankee way. But her kindness undid me, and it all came pouring out. Con's misery, the depth of which I'm convinced neither of our parents comprehended, in spite of their very real concern. My mother's fear that his vocal cords had been ruptured, and he might never speak again. Her insistence on a specialist, and Dad's on how they couldn't afford it. Most of all, the shouting. I didn't tell Patsy about the stranger's voice I had heard coming from my mother's mouth, but only because I could not think how to say it.
When I finally ran down, she said, "Come around to the back shed. You need to talk to Charlie."
Now that the Belvedere had taken its proper place in the parsonage garage, the back shed had become Jacob's workshop. When Patsy led me in, he was tinkering with a television set that had no screen. "When I put this puppy back together," he said, slinging an arm around my shoulders and producing a handkerchief from his back pocket, "I'll be able to get TV stations in Miami, Chicago, and Los Angeles."
"Wipe your eyes, Jamie, and your nose could use a little attention while you're at it."
I looked at the eyeless TV with fascination as I cleaned up.
"Will you really be able to get stations in Chicago and Los Angeles?"
"No, I was kidding. I'm just trying to build in a signal amplifier that will let us get something besides Channel 8.
"We get 6 and 13, too," I said. "Although 6 is a little snowstormy."
"You guys have a roof antenna. The Jacobs family is stuck with rabbit ears."
"Why don't you buy one? They sell them at Western Auto in Castle Rock."
He grinned.
"Good idea.
I'll stand up in front of the deacons at quarterly meeting and tell them I want to spend some of the collection money on a TV antenna, so Maury can watch Mighty 90, and the missus and I can watch Petticoat Junction on Tuesday nights."
"Never mind that, Jamie.
Tell me what's got you in such a tizzy." I looked around for Mrs. Jacobs, hoping she'd spare me the job of having to tell everything twice, but she had quietly decamped. He took me by the shoulders and led me to a sawhorse. I was just tall enough to be able to sit on it.
"Is it Con?"
Of course he'd guessed that. A petition for the return of Con's voice was part of the closing prayer at every Thursday night meeting that spring, as were prayers for other MYFers who were going through hard times. Broken bones were the most common, but Bobby Underwood had suffered burns, and Carrie Doughty had to endure having her head shaved and rinsed with vinegar after her horrified mother discovered the little girl's scalp was crawling with lice. But, like his wife, Reverend Jacobs hadn't had any idea of how miserable Con really was, or how that misery had spread through the entire family like an especially nasty germ.
"Dad bought Hiram Oil last summer," I said, starting to blubber again. I hated it. Blubbering was such a little kid's trick, but I couldn't seem to help it. "He said the price was too good to turn down, only then we had a warm winter, and heating oil went down to 15 cents a gallon, and now they can't afford a specialist, and if you could have heard her, she didn't sound like Mom at all, and sometimes he puts his hands in his pockets because..."
But Yankee reticence finally kicked in, and I finished.
"Because I don't know why."
He produced the handkerchief again, and while I used it, he took a metal box from his workshop table. Wires sprouted from it every which way, like badly cut hair. "Behold the amplifier," he said, "invented by yours truly. Once I get it hooked up, I'll run a wire out the window and up to the eave, and then I will attach that." He pointed to the corner, where a rake was propped on his pole with its rusty metal tines sticking up. "The Jacobs Custom Antenna."
"Will it work?" I asked.
"I don't know. I think it will. But even if it does, I believe the days of television antennas are numbered. In another 10 years, TV signals will be carried along the telephone lines, and there'll be a lot more than 3 channels. By 1990 or so, the signals will be beamed down from satellites. I know it sounds like science fiction, but the technology already exists." He had this dreamy look, and I thought, he's forgotten all about Con. Now I know that wasn't true. He was just giving me time to regain my composure and, maybe, himself time to think. People will be amazed at first, and then they'll take it for granted. They'll say, "Oh, yes, we have telephone TV. Or, we have Earth satellite TV." But they'll be wrong. It's all a gift of electricity, which is now so basic and so pervasive, we have a way of ignoring it. People like to say, thus and such is the elephant in the living room, meaning a thing that's too big to be ignored. But you'd even ignore an elephant if it was in the living room long enough.
"Except when you had to clean up the poop," I said.
That made him roar with laughter, and I laughed along with him, even though my eyes were still swollen from crying. He went to the window and looked out. He clasped his hands at the small of his back and didn't speak for a long time. Then he turned to me and said, "I want you to bring Con to the parsonage tonight. Will you do that?" "Sure," I said, without any great enthusiasm. More praying is what I thought he had in store. And I knew it couldn't hurt. But there had been a lot of praying on Con's behalf already, and it hadn't helped either. My parents had no objections to our going to the parsonage. I had to ask them separately, because that night they were barely talking to each other. It was Connie who took convincing, probably because I wasn't very convinced myself. But because I had promised the Reverend, I didn't give up. I enlisted Claire for help instead. Her belief in the power of prayer was far greater than my own, and she had her own powers. I think they came from being the only girl. Of the four Morton brothers, only Andy, who was closest to her in age, could resist her when she got all pretty-eyed and asked for something. As the three of us crossed Route 9, our shadows long in the light of a rising full moon, Con, just 13 that year, dark-haired, slender, dressed in a faded plaid jacket handed down from Andy, held up his notepad, which he carried everywhere. He had printed while he walked, so the letters were jagged. "This is stupid." "Maybe," Claire said, "but we'll get cookies. Mrs. Jacobs always has cookies." We also got Maury, now 5 and dressed for bed in his PJs. He ran directly to Con and jumped into his arms.
"Still can't talk?"
Maury asked. Con shook his head.
"My dad will fix you," he said. "He's been working all afternoon."
Then he held his arms out to my sister.
"Carry me, Claire. Carry me, Claire Bear, and I'll give you a kiss."
She took him from Con, laughing. Reverend Jacobs was in the shed, dressed in faded jeans and a sweater. There was an electric heater in the corner, the elements glowing cherry red, but his workshop was still cold. I suppose he had been too busy tinkering away on his various projects to winterize it. The temporarily eyeless TV had been covered with a mover's quilt. Jacobs gave Claire a hug and a peck on the cheek, then shook hands with Con, who then held up his pad.
"More prayer, I suppose," was printed on the fresh page.
I thought that was a little rude, and by her frown I could see Claire felt the same. But Jacobs only smiled. "We might get to that, but I want to try something else first." He turned to me. "Whom does the Lord help, Jamie?"
"Them that help themselves," I said.
Ungrammatical, but true. He went to the work table and brought back what looked like either a fat cloth belt or the world's skinniest electric blanket. A cord dangled from it, going to a little white plastic box with a slide switch on top. Jacob stood with the belt in his hands, looking at Con gravely. "This is a project I've been tinkering with on and off for the last year. I call it the electrical nerve stimulator."
"One of your inventions?" I said.
"Not exactly. The idea of using electricity to limit pain and stimulate muscles is very, very old. 60 years before the birth of Christ, a Roman doctor named Scribonius Largus discovered that foot and leg pain could be alleviated if the sufferer stepped firmly on an electric eel."
"You made that up,"
Claire accused, laughing. Con wasn't laughing. He was staring at the cloth belt with fascination.
"Not at all," Jacob said.
"But mine uses small batteries, which are of my invention, for power. Electric eels are hard to come by in central Maine, and even harder to put around a boy's neck, which is what I intend to do with this homemade ENS gadget of mine. Because Dr. Renault might have been right about your vocal cords not being ruptured, Con. Maybe they only need a jump start. I'm willing to make the experiment, but it's up to you. What do you say?" Con nodded. In his eyes, I saw an expression that hadn't been there in quite a while. Hope.
"How come you never showed us this in MYF?" Claire asked.
She sounded almost accusing. Jacobs looked surprised and a tiny bit uneasy. I suppose I couldn't think how it connected to a Christian lesson. Until Jamie came to see me today, I was thinking of trying it out on Al Knowles, his unfortunate accident. We all nodded, the fingers lost in the potato grater. He still feels the fingers that aren't there, and says they hurt. Also, he's lost a good deal of his ability to move that hand because of nerve damage. As I said, I've known for years that electricity can help in matters like those. Now it looks like you'll be my guinea pig, Con. So having that handy was just a lucky break? Claire asked. I couldn't see why it mattered, but it seemed to her, at least. Jacobs looked at her reproachfully and said, Coincidence and lucky break are words people with little faith use to describe the will of God, Claire. She flushed at that and looked down at her sneakers. Con, meanwhile, was scribbling on his pad. He held it up.
Will it hurt?
I don't think so, Jacob said. The current is very low, minuscule, really. I've tried it on my arm, like a blood pressure cuff, and felt no more than the tingle you get when your arm or leg has been asleep and is just beginning to wake up. If there is pain, raise your hands, and I'll kill the current right away. I'm going to put this thing on now. It'll be snug, but not tight. You'll be able to breathe just fine. The buckles are nylon. Can't use metal on a thing like this. He put the belt around Con's neck. It looked like a bulky winter scarf. Con's eyes were wide and scared, but when Jacobs asked if he was ready, he nodded. I felt Claire's fingers close over mine. They were cold. I thought Jacobs might get to the prayer then, asking for success. In a way, I suppose he did. He bent down so he could look Con directly in the eyes and said, Expect a miracle. Con nodded. I saw the cloth around his throat rise and fall as he swallowed hard. All right, here we go. When Reverend Jacob slid the switch on top of the control box, I heard a faint humming sound. Con's head jerked. His mouth twitched, first at one corner, then at the other. His fingers began to flutter rapidly, and his arms jerked. Does it hurt? Jacobs asked. His index finger was hovering over the switch, ready to turn it off. If it hurts, hold out your hands. Con shook his head. Then, in a voice that sounded as if it were coming through a mouthful of gravel, he said,
Doesn't hurt. Warm.
Claire and I exchanged a wild glance, a thought as strong as telepathy flowing between us. Did I hear that? She was now squeezing my hand hard enough to hurt, but I didn't care. When we looked back at Jacobs, he was smiling. Don't try to talk. Not yet. I'm going to run the belt for 2 minutes by my watch. Unless it starts to hurt, if that happens, hold out your hands and I'll turn it off at once. Con didn't hold out his hands, although his fingers continued to move up and down as if he were playing an invisible piano. His upper lip lifted a few times in an involuntary snarl, and his eyes went through spasms of fluttering. Once, still in that grating, gravelly voice, he said,
I can talk again.
Hush, Jacob said sternly. His index finger hovered over the switch, ready to kill the current, his eyes on the moving second hand of his watch. After what seemed like an eternity, he pushed the switch, and that faint hum died. He unloosed the buckles and pulled the belt over my brother's head. Con's hands went immediately to his neck. The skin there was a little flushed, but I don't think that was from the electric current. It was from the pressure of the belt. Now, Con, I want you to say, My dog has fleas. They bite his knees. But if your throat starts to hurt, stop at once.
My dog has fleas,
Con said in his strange, grating voice.
They bite his knees.
Then
I have to spit.
Does your throat hurt?
No, just have to spit.
Claire opened the shed door. Con leaned out cleared his throat, which produced an unpleasantly metallic sound like rusty hinges, and hawked a loogie that, to me, looked almost as big as a doorknob. He turned back to us, massaging his throat with one hand.
My dog has fleas.
He still didn't sound like the con I remembered, but the words were clearer now, and more human. Tears rose in his eyes and began to spill down his cheeks.
They bite his knees.
That's enough for now, Jacob said. We'll go in the house, and you'll drink a glass of water, a big one. You must drink a lot of water, tonight and tomorrow, until your voice sounds normal again. Will you do that?
Yes.
When you get home, you may tell your mother and father hello, and then I want you to go into your room and get down on your knees and thank God for bringing your voice back. Will you do that? Con nodded vehemently. He was crying harder than ever. And he wasn't alone. Claire and I were crying, too. Only Reverend Jacobs was dry-eyed. I think he was too amazed to cry. Patsy was the only one not surprised. When we went into the house, she squeezed Con's arm and said in a matter-of-fact voice, "That's a good boy." Maury hugged my brother, and my brother hugged him back hard enough to make the little boy's eyes bug out. Patsy drew a glass of water from the kitchen tap, and Con drank all of it. When he thanked her, it was almost in his own voice. "You're very welcome, Con. Now it's well past Maury's bedtime, and time for you kids to go home." Leading Maury to the stairs by the hand, but not turning around, she added, "I think your parents are going to be very happy." That was the understatement of the century. They were in the living room, watching The Virginian, and still not talking. Even in my joy and excitement, I could feel the freeze between them. Andy and Terry were thumping around upstairs, grousing at each other about something. Business as usual, in other words. Mom had an Afghan square in her lap, and was bending over to unsnarl the yarn in her basket when Con said, "Hello, Mom. Hello, Dad." Dad stared at him, mouth open. Mom froze, one hand in the basket and the other holding her needles. She looked up very slowly. She said, "What?"
"Hello," Con said again.
She screamed and flew out of her chair, kicking the knitting basket over, and grabbed him the way she sometimes had when we were little and meant to give one of us a shaking for something we had done wrong. There was no shaking that night. She swept Con into her arms, weeping. I could hear Terry and Andy stampeding down from the second floor to see what was going on. "Say something else," she cried. "Say something else so I don't think I just dreamed it." "He's not supposed to," Claire began, but Con interrupted her because now he could.
"I love you, Mom," he said. "I love you, Dad."
Dad took Con by the shoulders and looked closely at his throat, but there was now nothing to see. The red mark had faded.
"Thank God," he said. "Thank God, son."
Claire and I looked at each other, and once more the thought didn't need to be spoken. Reverend Jacobs deserved some thanks, too. We explained about how Con was supposed to use his voice sparingly to start with, and when we told about the water, Andy went out to the kitchen and came back with Dad's oversized joke coffee cup. Printed on the side was the Canadian flag and 1 imperial gallon of caffeine. Filled with water. While he drank it, Claire and I took turns recounting what had happened, with Con chipping in once or twice, telling about the tingling sensation he'd felt when the belt was turned on. Each time he interrupted, Claire scolded him for talking.
"I don't believe it."
Mom said this several times. She couldn't seem to take her eyes off Con. Several times she grabbed him and hugged him, as if she was afraid he might sprout wings, turn into an angel, and fly away. "If the church didn't pay for his heating oil," Dad said when the tale was finished, "Reverend Jacobs would never have to pay for another gallon." "We'll think of something," Mom said distractedly. "Right now we're going to celebrate. Terry, fetch the ice cream we were saving for Claire's birthday from the freezer. It'll be good for Con's throat. You and Andy put it on the table. We'll have all of it, so use the big bowls. You don't mind, do you, Claire?" She shook her head. This is better than a birthday party.
I have to go to the bathroom, Connie said. All that water. Then I'm supposed to pray. Reverend said so. The rest of you stay out while I do it.
He went upstairs. Andy and Terry went into the kitchen to serve out the Neapolitan, which we called Van Chalk Straw. Funny how it all comes back. My mother and father subsided into their chairs, staring at the TV without seeing it. I saw Mom grope out with one hand, and saw Dad take it without looking, as if he knew it was there. That made me happy and relieved. I felt a tug on my own hand. It was Claire. She led me through the kitchen, where Andy and Terry were squabbling over the relative size of the portions, and into the mudroom. Her eyes, when she looked at me, were wide and bright. "Did you see him?" she asked. "No," demanded.
"Who?" "Reverend Jacobs, stupid. Did you see him when I asked why he never showed us that electric belt in MYF?
"Well, yeah."
"He said he'd been working on it for a year, but if that was true, he would have showed it off. He shows off everything he makes."
I remembered how surprised he had looked, as if Claire had caught him out. I had, on more than one occasion, felt the same expression on my own face when I'd been caught out, but...
"Are you saying he was lying?"
She nodded vigorously.
"Yes, he was. And his wife, she knew it. Do you know what I think? I think he started right after you were there. Maybe he already had the idea. I think he has thousands of ideas for electrical inventions. They must pop around in his head like corn. But he hadn't done anything at all on this one until today."
"Gee, Claire, I don't think..."
She was still holding my hand. Now she gave it a hard and impatient yank, as if I were stuck in the mud and needed help to get free.
"Did you see their kitchen table? There was one plate still set, with nothing on the plate and nothing in the glass. He skipped his supper so he could keep working. Working like a demon, I guess, from the look of his hands. They were all red, and there were blisters on two of his fingers."
"He did all that for Con?"
"I don't think so," she said.
Her eyes never left mine.
"Claire, Jamie," Mom called, "come for ice cream."
Claire didn't even look toward the kitchen.
"Of all the kids in MYF, you're the one he met first, and you're the one he likes the best. He did it for you, Jamie. He did it for you."
Then she went into the kitchen, leaving me to stand by the woodpile, feeling stunned. If Claire had stayed a little longer, and I'd had a chance to get over my surprise, I might have told her my own intuition. Reverend Jacobs had been as surprised as we were. He hadn't expected it to work.
Chapter 3. The Accident. My Mother's Story. The Terrible Sermon. Goodbye. On a warm and cloudless midweek day in October of 1965, Patricia Jacobs popped Tagalong Maury into the front seat of the Plymouth Belvedere that had been a wedding present from her parents and set out for the red and white market in Gates Falls.
"She gone groceryin'," the Yankees of that time would have said.
3 miles away, a farmer named George Barton, a lifelong bachelor known in town as Lonesome George, pulled out of his driveway with a potato digger attached to the back of his Ford F-100 pickup. His plan was to drive it a mile or so down Route 9 to his south field, the best speed he could manage with the digger attached was 10 miles an hour, so he kept to the soft shoulder, thereby allowing any southbound traffic to pass safely. Lonesome George was considerate of others. He was a fine farmer. He was a good neighbor, a member of the school board, and a deacon of our church. He was also, as he would tell people almost proudly, a pepileptic, although he was quick to add Dr. Renault had prescribed some pills that controlled the seizures, just about perfect. Maybe so, but he had one behind the wheel of his truck that day.
"Probably shouldn't have been driving at all, except maybe in the fields," Dr. Renault said later. "But how can you ask a man in George's line of work to give up his license? It's not as if he has a wife or any grown kids he can put behind the wheel. Take away his driving ticket, he
You might as well ask him to put his farm up for sale to the highest bidder. Not long after Patsy and Maury set out for the Red and White, Mrs. Adele Parker came down Seroy Hill, a tight and treacherous curve where there had been many wrecks over the years. She was creeping along, and so had time to stop, barely, before striking the woman staggering and weaving up the middle of the highway. The woman had a dripping bundle clasped to her breast with one arm. One arm was all Patsy Jacobs could use, because the other had been torn off at the elbow. Blood was pouring down her face. A piece of her scalp hung beside her shoulder, bloody locks of hair blowing in the mild autumn breeze. Her right eye was on her cheek. All her beauty had been torn away in an instant. It's fragile, beauty.
"Help my baby,"
Patsy cried when Mrs. Parker stopped her old Studebaker and got out. Beyond the bloody woman with a dripping bundle, Mrs. Parker could see the Belvedere, on its roof and burning. The stove-in front end of Lonesome George's truck was pushed against it. George himself was slumped over the wheel. Behind his truck, the overturned potato digger was blocking Route 9.
"Help my baby."
Patsy held the bundle out, and when Adele Parker saw what it was, not a baby, but a little boy with his face torn off, she covered her eyes and began to scream. When she looked again, Patsy had gone to her knees, as if to pray. Another pickup truck came around Seroy Hill and almost slammed into the back of Mrs. Parker's Studebaker. It was Fernald DeWitt, who had promised to help George with the digging that day. He jumped from the cab, ran to Mrs. Parker, and looked at the woman kneeling in the road. Then he ran on toward the site of the collision.
"Where are you going?"
Mrs. Parker screamed.
"Help her! Help this woman!"
Fernald, who had fought with the Marines in the Pacific and seen terrible sights there, did not pause, but he did call back over his shoulder.
"She and the kid are gone. George might not be."
Nor was he wrong. Patsy was dead long before the ambulance arrived from Castle Rock. But Lonesome George Barton lived into his 80s and never got behind the wheel of a motor vehicle again. You say, how could you know all that, Jamie Morton? You were only 9 years old. But I do know it. In 1976, when my mother was still a relatively young woman, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. I was attending the University of Maine at the time, but took the second semester of my sophomore year off, so I could be with her at the end. Although the Morton children were children no more, Con was all the way over the horizon in Hawaii, doing pulsar research at the Mauna Kea observatories. We all came home to be with Mom and to support Dad, who was too heartbroken to be useful. He simply wandered around the house or took long walks in the woods. Mom wanted to spend her final days at home. She was very clear about that, and we took turns feeding her, giving her her medicine, or just sitting with her. She was little more than a skeleton by then, and on morphine for the pain. Morphine's funny stuff. It has a way of eroding barriers, that famous Yankee reticence, which would otherwise be impregnable. It was my turn to sit with her on a February afternoon, a week or so before she died. It was a day of snow flurries and bitter cold, with a north wind that shook the house and screamed beneath the eaves. But the house was warm. Hot, really. My father was in the heating oil business, remember, and after that one scary year in the mid-60s when he looked bankruptcy in the face, he became not just successful, but moderately wealthy.
"Push down my blankets, Terence,"
my mother said.
"Why are there so many? I'm burning up."
"It's Jamie, Mom. Terry's out in the garage with Dad." I turned down the single blanket, exposing a hideously gay pink nightgown that seemed to have nothing inside it. Her hair, all white by the time the cancer struck, had thinned to almost nothing. Her lips had fallen away from her teeth, making them look too big, and somehow equine. Only her eyes were the same. They were still young,
and full of hurt curiosity. What's happening to me? Jamie, Jamie, that's what I said. Can I have a pill? The pain is awful today. I've never been in such a hole as this one.
In 15 minutes, Mom. It was supposed to be 2 hours, but I couldn't see what difference it made at that point. Claire had suggested giving her all of them, which shocked Andy. He was the only one of us who had remained true to our fairly strict religious upbringing.
Do you want to send her to hell?
He had asked. She wouldn't go to hell if we gave them to her, Claire said, quite reasonably, I thought. It isn't as if she'd know. And then, nearly breaking my heart because it was one of our mother's favorite sayings, she doesn't know if she's afoot or on horseback, not anymore. You'll do no such thing, Andy said.
No, Claire sighed.
She was closing in on 30 by then, and was more beautiful than ever, because she was finally in love. If so, what a bitter irony. I don't have that kind of courage. I only have the courage to let her suffer. When she's in heaven, her suffering will only be a shadow, Andy said, as if this ended the matter. For him, I suppose it did. The wind howled, the old panes of glass in the bedroom single window rattled, and my mother said, I'm so thin, so thin now. I was a pretty bride. Everyone said so. But now Laura McKenzie is so thin. Her mouth drew down in a clown moo of sorrow and pain. I had 3 more hours in the room with her before Terry was due to spell me. She might sleep some of that time, but she wasn't sleeping now, and I was desperate to distract her from the way her body was cannibalizing itself. I might have seized on anything. It just happened to be Charles Jacobs. I asked if she had any idea where he'd gone after he left Harlow.
Oh, that was a terrible time, she said. A terrible thing that happened to his wife and little boy.
Yes, I said. I know. My dying mother looked at me with stoned contempt.
You don't know. You don't understand. It was terrible because it was no one's fault. Certainly not George Barton's. He simply had a seizure.
She then told me what I have already told you. She heard it from the mouth of Adele Parker, who said she would never get the image of the dying woman out of her head.
What I'll never get out of mine, Mom said, was the way he screamed at Peabody's. I didn't know a man could make a sound like that.
Doreen DeWitt, Fernald's wife, called my mother and gave her the news. She had a good reason for calling Laura Morton first.
You'll have to tell him, she said.
My mother was horrified at the prospect.
Oh, no, I couldn't. You have to,
Doreen said patiently.
This isn't news you give over the phone. And except for that old gore crow, Myra Harrington, you're his closest neighbor.
My mother, all her reticence washed away by the morphine, told me,
I gathered up my courage to do it, but I was caught short as I was going out the door. I had to turn around and run to the toity and shit.
She walked down our hill across Route 9 and to the parsonage. She didn't say, but I imagine it was the longest walk of her life. She knocked on the door, but at first he didn't come, although she could hear the radio inside.
Why would he have heard me?
She inquired of the ceiling as I sat there beside her.
The first time. My knuckles barely grazed the wood.
She knocked harder the second time. He opened the door and looked at her through the screen. He was holding a large book in one hand, and all those years later she remembered the title, Protons and Neutrons, The Secret World of Electricity.
Hello, Laura, he said. Are you all right? You're very pale. Come in, come in.
She came in. He asked her what was wrong.
There's been a terrible accident,
she said. His look of concern deepened. Dick or one of the kids? Do you need me to come? Sit down, Laura. You look ready to faint.
All of mine are all right, she said. It's... Charles, it's Patsy. And Maury.
He set the big book carefully on a table in the hall. That was probably when she saw the title, and I'm not surprised that she remembered it. At such times, one sees everything and remembers it all. I know from personal experience. I wish I did not. How badly are they hurt? And before she could answer, are they at St. Stevie's? They must be. It's the closest. Can we take your station wagon? St. Stephen's Hospital was in Castle Rock. But, of course, that wasn't where they had been taken.
Charles, you must prepare yourself for a terrible shock.
He took her by the shoulders. Gently, she said, not hard. But when he bent to look into her face, his eyes were blazing.
How bad, Laura, how badly are they hurt?
My mother began to cry.
They're dead, Charles. I'm so sorry.
He let go of her, and his arms dropped to his sides. No, they're not, he said. It was the voice of a man stating a simple fact.
I should have driven down, my mother said. I should have brought the station wagon. Yes, I wasn't thinking. I just came.
They're not, he said again. He turned from her and put his forehead against the wall. No. He banged his head hard enough to rattle a nearby picture of Jesus carrying a lamb. No. He banged it again, and the picture fell off its hook. She took his arm. It was floppy and loose.
Charles, don't do that.
And as if he had been one of her children instead of a grown man, don't, honey.
No.
He banged his forehead again. No. Yet again.
No.
This time she took hold of him with both hands and pulled him away from the wall.
Stop that. You stop it right now.
He looked at her, dazed. A bright red mark dashed across his brow.
Such a look,
she told me years later, as she lay dying.
I couldn't bear it, but I had to. Once a thing like that is started, you have to finish it.
Walk back to the house with me, she told him. I'll give you a drink of Dick's whiskey because you need something, and I know there's nothing like that here. He laughed. It was a shocking sound.
And then I'll drive you to Gates Falls. They're at Peabody's.
Peabody's? She waited for it to sink in. He knew what Peabody's was as well as she did. By that time, Reverend Jacobs had officiated at dozens of funerals.
Patsy can't be dead, he said in a patient, instructional tone of voice. It's Wednesday. Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day. That's what Maury says. Come with me, Charles.
She took him by the hand and tugged him first to the door, and then into the gorgeous autumn sunshine. That morning he had awakened next to his wife and had eaten breakfast across from his son. They talked about stuff like people do. We never know. Any day could be the day we go down, and we never know. When they reached Route 9, sun-washed and silent, empty of traffic as it almost always was, he cocked his head, dog-like, toward the sound of sirens in the direction of Seroy Hill. On the horizon was a smudge of smoke. He looked at my mother.
Maury, too? You're sure?
Come on, Charlie.
It was the only time I ever called him that, she told me.
Come on. We're in the middle of the road. They went to Gates Falls in our old Ford wagon, and they went by way of Castle Rock. It was at least 20 miles longer, but my mother was past the worst of her shock by then, and able to think clearly. She had no intention of driving past the scene of the crash, even if it meant going all the way around Robin Hood's barn. Peabody's funeral home was on Grand Street. The gray Cadillac hearse was already in the driveway, and several vehicles were parked at the curb. One of them was Reggie Kelton's boat of a Buick. Another, she was enormously relieved to see, was a panel truck with Morton fuel oil on the side. Dad and Mr. Kelton came out the front door while Mom was leading Reverend Jacobs up the walk, by then as docile as a child. He was looking up, Mom said, as if to gauge how far the foliage had to go before it would reach peak color. Dad hugged Jacobs, but Jacobs didn't hug back. He just stood there with his hands at his sides, looking up at the leaves. "Charlie, I'm so sorry for your loss," Kelton rumbled. "We all are." They escorted him into the oversweet smell of flowers. Organ music, low as a whisper and somehow awful, came from overhead speakers. Myra Harrington, Meemaw to everyone in West Harlow, was already there, probably because she had been listening in on the party line when Doreen called my mother. Listening in was her hobby. She heaved her bulk from a sofa in the foyer and pulled Reverend Jacobs to her enormous bosom.
"Your dear, sweet wife, and your dear little boy," she cried in her high, mewling voice.
Mom looked at Dad, and they both winced.
"Well, they're in heaven now. That's the consolation. Saved by the blood of the Lamb and rocked in the everlasting arms."
Tears poured down Meemaw's cheeks, cutting through a thick layer of pink powder. Reverend Jacobs allowed himself to be hugged and made of. After a minute or two,
"Around the time, I began to think she wouldn't stop until she suffocated him with those great tits of hers," my mother told me.
He pushed her away, not hard, but with firmness. He turned to my father and Mr. Kelton and said, "I'll see them now."
"No, Charlie, not yet," Mr. Kelton said. "You need to hold on for a bit, just until Mr. Peabody makes them present."
Jacobs walked through the viewing parlor, where some old lady in a mahogany coffin was waiting for her final public appearance. He continued on down the hall toward the back. He knew where he was going. Few better. Dad and Mr. Kelton hurried after him. My mother sat down, and Meemaw sat across from her, eyes alight under a cloud of white hair. She was old then, in her 80s, and when some of her score of grandchildren and great-grandchildren weren't visiting her, only tragedy and scandal brought her fully alive.
"How did he take it?"
Meemaw stage whispered.
"Did you get knee-bound with him?"
"Not now, Myra," Mom said. "I'm done up. I only want to close my eyes and rest for a minute." But there was no rest for her, because just then a scream rose from the back of the funeral home where the prep rooms were.
"It sounded like the wind outside today, Jamie," she said. "Only 100 times worse."
At last she looked away from the ceiling. I wish she hadn't, because I could see the darkness of death close behind the light in her eyes.
"At first, there were no words, just that banshee wailing. I almost wish it had stayed that way, but it didn't. 'Where's his face?' he cried. 'Where's my little boy's face?'"
Who would preach at the funeral? This was a question, like who cuts the barber's hair, that troubled me. I heard all about it later, but I wasn't there to see. My mother decreed that only she, Dad, Claire, and Con were to go to the funeral. It might be too upsetting for the rest of us. Surely it was those chilling screams from Peabody's preparation room she was thinking of. And so Andy was left in charge of Terry and me. That wasn't a thing I relished, because Andy could be a booger snot, especially when our parents weren't there. For an avowed Christian, he was awfully fond of Indian rope burns and head noogies, hard ones that left you seeing stars. There were no rope burns or head noogies on the Saturday of Patsy and Maury's double funeral. Andy said that if the folks weren't back by supper, he'd make Franco American. In the meantime, we were just to watch TV and shut up. Then he went upstairs and didn't come back down. Grumpy and bossy though he could be, he had liked Tagalong Maury as much as the rest of us, And, of course, he had a crush on Patsy, also like the rest of us, except for Con, who didn't care for girls then and never would. He might have gone upstairs to pray. Go into your closet and lock your door, St. Matthew advises. Or maybe he just wanted to sit and think and try to make sense of it all. His faith wasn't broken by those two deaths. He remained a die-hard fundamentalist Christian until his death. But it must have been severely shaken. My own faith wasn't broken by the deaths either. It was the terrible sermon that accomplished that. Reverend David Thomas of the Gates Falls Congo gave the eulogy for Patsy and Maury at our church, and that caused no raised eyebrows, since, as my dad said, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Congregationalists and the Methodists. What did raise eyebrows was Jacob's choice of Stephen Givens to officiate at the Willow Grove Cemetery graveside services. Givens was the pastor, he did not call himself reverend, of Shiloh Church, where at that time the congregants still held hard to the beliefs of Frank Weston Sanford, an apocalypse monger who encouraged parents to whip their children for petty sins. "You must be schoolmasters of Christ," he advised them, and who insisted on 36-hour fasts, even for infants. Shiloh had changed a lot since Sanford's death, and is today little different from other Protestant church groups. But in 1965, a flock of old rumors, fueled by the odd dress of the members and their stated belief that the end of the world was coming soon, like maybe next week, persisted. Yet it turned out that our Charles Jacobs and their Stephen Givens had been meeting over coffee in Castle Rock for years, and were friends. After the terrible sermon, there were people in town who said that Reverend Jacobs had been infected by Shilohism. Perhaps so, but according to Mom and Dad, also Con and Claire, whose testimony I trusted more, Givens was calm, comforting, and appropriate during the brief graveside ceremony. "He didn't mention the end of the world once," Claire said. I remember how beautiful she looked that evening in her dark blue dress, the closest she had to black, and her grown-up hose. I also remember she ate almost no supper, just pushed things around on her plate until it was all mixed together and looked like dog whoop. "What scripture did Givens read?" Auntie asked. "First Corinthians," Mom said. "The one about how we see through a glass darkly?" "Good choice," my older brother said sagely. "How was he?" I asked Mom. "How was Reverend Jacobs?" "He was quiet," she said, looking troubled. "Meditating, I think." "No, he wasn't," Claire said, pushing her plate away. "He was shell-shocked, just sat there in a folding chair at the head of the grave. And when Mr. Givens asked him if he'd throw the first dirt and then join him in saying the benediction, he only went on sitting with his hands between his knees and his head hanging down." She began to cry. "It seems like a dream to me. A bad dream." "But he did get up and toss the dirt," Dad said, putting an arm around her shoulders. "After a while, he did. A handful on each coffin, didn't he, Claire Bear?"
"Yeah,"
she said, crying harder than ever. "After that Shiloh guy took his hands and practically pulled him up." Con hadn't said anything, and I realized he wasn't at the table anymore. I saw him out in the backyard, standing by the elm from which our tire swing hung. He was leaning his head against the bark, with his hands clasping the tree and his shoulders shaking. Unlike Claire, though, he had eaten his dinner. I remember that. Ate up everything on his plate, and asked for seconds in a strong, clear voice. There were guest preachers, arranged for by the deacons, on the next three Sundays, but Pastor Givens wasn't one of them. In spite of being calm, comforting, and appropriate at Willow Grove, I expect he wasn't asked. As well as being reticent by nature and upbringing, Yankees also have a tendency to be comfortably prejudiced in matters of religion and race. 3 years later, I heard one of my teachers at Gates Falls High School tell another, in tones of outraged wonder, "Now why would anyone want to shoot that Reverend King? Heaven's sakes, he was a good nigger." NYF was canceled following the accident. I think all of us were glad, even Andy, also known as Emperor of Bible Drills. We were no more ready to face Reverend Jacobs than he was to face us. Toy Corner, where Claire and the other girls had entertained Maury, and themselves, would have been awful to look at. And who would play the piano for sing time? I suppose someone in town could have done it, but Charles Jacobs was in no condition to ask, and it wouldn't have been the same anyway, without Patsy's blonde hair shifting from side to side as she swung the upbeat hymns like, "We are marching to Zion." Her blonde hair was underground now, growing brittle on a satin pillow in the dark. One gray November afternoon, while Terry and I were spray-stenciling turkeys and cornucopias on our windows, the telephone jangled one long and one short. Our ring. Mom answered, spoke briefly, then put the phone down and smiled at Terry and me. That was Reverend Jacobs. He's going to be in the pulpit this coming Sunday to preach the Thanksgiving sermon. Won't that be nice? Years later, I was in high school, and Claire was home on vacation from the University of Maine. I asked my sister why nobody had stopped him. We were out back, pushing the old tire swing. She didn't have to ask who I meant. That Sunday sermon had left a scar on all of us. Because he sounded so reasonable, I think. So normal. By the time people realized what he was actually saying, it was too late. Maybe. But I remembered both Reggie Kelton and Roy Easterbrook interrupting him near the end. And I knew something was wrong even before he started, because he didn't follow that day's scriptural reading with a customary conclusion. May God bless his holy word. He never forgot that. Not even on the day I met him, when he showed me the little electric Jesus walking across Peaceable Lake. His scripture on the day of the terrible sermon was from the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, the same passage Pastor Givens read over the twin graves, one big, one small, at Willow Grove. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass, darkly. But then face to face, now I know in part. But then shall I know, even as also I am known. He closed the large Bible on the pulpit. Not hard, but we all heard the thump. West Harlow Methodist was full on that Sunday. Every pew taken. But it was dead quiet. Not so much as a cough. I remember praying he'd get through it okay. That he wouldn't break down in tears. Myra Harrington, Meemaw, was in the front pew, and although her back was to me, I could imagine her eyes, half buried in their fatty, yellowish sockets and sparkling with avidity. My family was in the third pew, where we always sat. Mom's face was serene, but I could see her white-gloved hands clenched on her large, soft-covered Bible with enough force to bend it into a U. Claire had nibbled off her lipstick. The silence between the conclusion of the scripture reading and the commencement of what was known in Harlow ever after as the terrible sermon could not have been much longer than 5 seconds, 10 at the most. But to me it seemed to stretch out forever. His head was bowed over the huge pulpit Bible with its bright gold edging. When he finally looked up and showed his calm, composed face, a faint sigh of relief rippled through the congregation. "This has been a hard and troubled time for me," he said. "I hardly need to tell you that. This is a close-knit community, and we all know each other. You folks have reached out to me in every way you could, and I'll always be grateful. I want especially to thank Laura Morton, who brought me the news of my loss with such tenderness and gentle regard." He nodded to her. She nodded back, smiled,
then raised one white-gloved hand to brush away a tear. I have spent much of the time between the day of my loss and this Sunday morning in reflection and study. I would like to add, in prayer, but although I have gotten on my knees time and again, I have not sensed the presence of God. And so reflection and study had to do. Silence from the congregation, every eye on him. I went to the Gates Falls Library in search of the New York Times, but all they have on file is the Weekly Enterprise. So I was directed to Castle Rock, where they have the Times on microfilm. Seek, and ye shall find, St. Matthew tells us, and how right he was. A few low chuckles greeted this, but they died away quickly. I went day after day. I scrolled microfilm until my head ached, and I want to share some of the things I found. From the pocket of his black suit coat, he took a few file cards. In June of last year, three small tornadoes tore through the town of May, Oklahoma. Although there was property damage, no one was killed. The townsfolk flocked to the Baptist church to sing songs of praise and offer prayers of thanksgiving. While they were in there, a fourth tornado, a monster F5, swept down on May and demolished the church. 41 persons were killed. 30 others were seriously injured, including children who lost arms and legs. He shuffled that card to the bottom and looked at the next. Some of you may remember this one. In August of last year, a man and his two sons set out on Lake Winnipesaukee in a rowboat. They had the family dog with them. The dog fell overboard, and both boys jumped in to rescue him. When the father saw his sons were in danger of drowning, he jumped in himself, inadvertently overturned